From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. During the chaos in Tahrir Square in Cairo, we managed to get in touch with one of the protesters who was tweeting vigorously from the ground. Mona Saif is an activist and postgraduate student in cancer research at Cairo University. She joined us Thursday night from the square.
Today they were trying different ways of weakening us and undermining us. They harass any protesters trying to join us or to bring us food or medical supplies. They also crack down on most of our legal support. They have arrested them. One of them is my dad. We do not know where they are right now. Despite all of this, the spirit is still good. The numbers are still great.
I'm interested in your journey to get to where you are now in Tahrir Square. And I'm particularly interested to know how much Twitter and Facebook, SMS, played a part.
All the social networks played an extremely important role. The choice of the day was because the 25th of January, the state decided 2 years ago to name it Police Day, where we celebrate all the great things the police do to us. And of course, our police are completely corrupted. So the call was to take that day and really show our rage at the corruption of the state. And the ongoing joke on the internet then was how you cannot set an event on Facebook saying, okay, prepare yourself, revolution is in next week. But apparently you can.
So you can run a revolution like a birthday party.
It turns out that, yes, I'm not sure if any country could do that, but apparently in Egypt you can set it up an event on Facebook and it becomes serious.
At an early stage, the government realized what was happening on social networks and just cut off internet communication entirely. How were the groups able to mobilize and carry out their plans in the absence of this kind of social communication?
That's the point where the government, I think, made a misjudgment. The social networks played a great role to call for the 25th of January. When it became apparent that it is no longer just a small protest and that it is becoming bigger and bigger than what we had expected, it became really a street movement. It was going to go on, no matter what are the available methods of communication. By chance, one of our friends still had internet connection. She was so scared to admit it because she didn't want to get it shut down. She had her wireless provided by one small company which had all the stock and financial exchanges. So the government were not ready to shut down this particular company yet. So she turned her place into our technological hub. Basically, we were more than 25 people there. We all go to join the different protests going around Cairo, get as much footage as we can, run back to her place. We all set up our laptops, send out all this material outside to newspapers and TV channels, and then get back to the street to get more footage and so on.
It's like somehow using a government tank to get behind enemy lines. It's a funny Trojan horse. Provided to you by the government.
Yes. We really were trying to make sure that some leakage of info would get out, and then it's up to the virtual world on the internet to help it spread. Landlines were not shut down at all. So in case we don't have any access to the internet, we can call our international correspondents and tell them the updates of the protest. We also had a friend hidden away with one satellite device, just in case every other method of communication was shut down. And we sent out his number to a couple of contacts so they call him and get any updates from him. And we call him on landlines to give him the update.
When the government shut off the internet, did it have a backlash of infuriating people who otherwise would not have mobilized?
I think it had a backlash, but not because of infuriating people. A lot of the people who would have normally been satisfied with just following the updates on Facebook and Twitter suddenly did not have this connection. And so they found no way of being part of this movement except by going out in the streets. So I actually think that cutting off the internet helped the movement on the real ground and in the street become bigger.
We get a lot of criticism here in the West about Twitter. Would you like to take this opportunity to explain to skeptics what Twitter can mean?
Yeah, I understand this criticism because I've been getting it a lot from my friends. And I think sometimes it needs an experience like the one we are just in to really grasp how powerful such a tool like Twitter is. The use of Twitter in engaging different people in bits of your life is really what makes it a powerful tool when there is a serious event and you want to engage people. Because if it's only used as a news feed, then it would be boring and it wouldn't be as interactive as it should be. Usually I use Twitter for really personal things. So I just share moments from my work or moments from my love life or talk about my cats or my family. And it engages lots of different people. So when these people are following you and suddenly you're talking about a torture case, some of them might not usually be exposed to such cases. But because they are following me and there is an ongoing conversation between us, they would suddenly be engaged in this as well. So it's a really powerful tool in that sense.
The movement has coalesced a number of forces of anger at the regime. There are trade unionists, there are Muslim Brotherhood elements, there are young people who have been facing hopelessness and despair and unemployment. How worried are you that what comes next may be worse than the status quo, for example, an Islamic revolution?
I really am not worried, and I know this might sound strange for a lot of people, but what I have seen during the last 9 days is making me really hopeful. I'm in Tahrir Square with thousands of people from completely different backgrounds, and for once in my life, all of the big issues that we are usually encountering in the streets of Egypt and having to deal with, like violence and tension and secular problems and sexual harassment against girls and all of these issues that we keep on talking about, they do not exist. I'm in Tahrir Square feeling that I belong with those people and they are everyone. There are Muslim Brotherhood, there are independent people who do not belong to any party. I really, really think that this could come up with a much, much better scenario than what all of the outside world is expecting or fearing.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
Mona Saif spoke to us from Tahrir Square in downtown Cairo.
Just as the regular Egyptians on the ground had to improvise after their government shut down the internet for a few days, Al Jazeera found ways to report in Egypt, changing its satellite frequencies, checking social media, fielding reporters on the scene, even as they were hunted by the authorities. When we spoke to Al Jazeera's Director General Wada Khanfar last year, he told us that his network gave a voice to the voiceless. And Middle East expert Mark Lynch told us a few weeks ago that Al Jazeera's coverage had framed a narrative that united the whole Arab world, one of a single people struggling against many authoritarian regimes. The New York Times wrote recently that Al Jazeera's, quote, aggressive coverage has helped propel insurgent emotions from one capital to another. Al Anstey, managing director of Al Jazeera English, says not so.
It's not our job to propel, but obviously as a network which is covering the stories in the way that we do, then those pictures are seen in other countries. We're covering the stories, and we're broadcasting those stories, and we're broadcasting in the way that we do, i.e. factually balanced, and that is enabling people to see what's going on in the world. We're covering, not creating.
A lot of journalists in Egypt have been targeted, but especially Al Jazeera, because it's been bringing the events of the square to the world in a way that no other media outlet has been able to.
We have been targeted in recent days. Unfortunately, we're seeing all journalists targeted today. But one of the fundamental reasons why Al Jazeera in particular has been highlighted is because we are broadcasting live the events that are going on, which some parties in this story may not want to be seen. Not that long ago, weeks and months ago, if there'd been a protest against President Mubarak, that would not have been seen on state television, that would not have been seen on Egyptian television. It is unprecedented in Egypt, in modern Egypt, to have this level of opposition publicly seen.
Do you think, given that the viewing of Al Jazeera online or on various services expanded incredibly in the United States, a market that the network Al Jazeera English has found incredibly hard to crack. It's been carried in Washington and hardly anywhere else. Do you think there's a chance now that you'll finally find a berth on an American cable system?
Our web traffic in the first couple of days of this story was up 2,500%, of which 50% plus was from the United States. And those are figures for people reading us online, but also live streaming us through Al Jazeera English's website and watching our TV output online. That is evidence of a demand. And it's a recognition for me that we are putting out very high quality, very balanced content, which is appreciated because we've seen that demand rise and rise and rise.
It's a pretty reasonable assumption to draw, given the spiking viewership in the United States, that you've managed to blast through some of the prejudices about Al Jazeera. It's been called anti-Western and accused of having institutional sympathy for Islamist extremists. In the days before the Egyptian uprising, your network began releasing a series of more than 1,600 leaked documents known as the Palestine Papers, which reveal confidential details of negotiations between American, Israeli, and Palestinian Authority officials. The president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, accused Al Jazeera of distorting his positions, not for the first time, inciting violence and trying to destroy him by leaking the documents. His loyalists even attacked your network's office in Ramallah. In the Al Jazeera narrative, is the Palestinian Authority, the repressive government, and Hamas the voice of the voiceless?
It's not for Al Jazeera to say whether one side of a story or another is repressive or progressive or one thing or another thing. It is for us to cover exactly what is going on the ground now and provide the analysis and context when necessary, when relevant, so the viewers and our audiences get the full picture of the story. It is truly objective reporting. And when we get documents which we go through and we apply the higher standards of journalism to those documents, we're reporting that story. We're not reporting one side or other of that story.
Al Anstey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Al Anstey is the managing director of Al Jazeera English.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If, like us, you were glued to your TV watching the protests in Egypt this week, you might have noticed that one phrase kept coming up again and again.
Street, the Arab street in Cairo, David, senses weakness on the part of President...
It does seem that what's going on the Arab street now is something that perhaps was a long time in
coming. The Arab street, the Egyptian street, is sending a clear message, but
But where does that term come from, and what do we mean when we say Arab street? Two professors have actually studied the phrase's origins and usage. Surprisingly, they found that commentators in the West aren't the only people who refer to the Arab street. Arabic language newspapers actually use the phrase as well. York University professor Muhammad Ali Khalidi is one of the academics who worked on the paper. Muhammad, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Just from a personal standpoint, what has been your reaction when you read the Western press and see that phrase?
Well, I've always bristled at the phrase. I've always felt that there's something a little bit pejorative about it. And it always struck me as striking a bit of a false note. It sort of equates the whole of the Arab public with gangs or a street mob. And that always seemed to me to be very unfortunate and very unfair.
I've just got to tell you that I always just read it as a synonym for Arab public opinion. So when you did the research, what did you discover about the nuance of the term both in the Arab press and in the West?
One is that precisely it has become a stand-in for Arab public opinion. It turns out that in the past decade or so, about 85% of mentions of Arab public opinion use that phrase, the Arab street, instead of talking about the Arab public, which is problematic because you don't always associate public opinion with necessarily people who are demonstrating out in the street. Public opinion takes many different forms. The other thing is that it's almost unique to the Arab world. You never, almost never hear or see mention of, say, the Chinese street or the European street or the Israeli street in American and other Anglophone media.
Come to think of it, I never heard anyone talk about the French street or the American street, for that matter. Is this just one of those terms that journalists pick up because they think it's got a certain je ne sais quoi?
I think that our research shows that there's something about it that might not be so innocent, because it was almost non-existent in the 80s and 90s. And given that we found that the term seems to be statistically far more likely to be associated with adjectives that indicate irrationality or volatility or violence even, we think that its rise coincides with a somewhat suspicious attitude towards the Arab public in the U.S. media, due to several factors, one of which is perhaps 9/11, when a lot of people came to see the Arab public in a rather sinister light.
And when Arab commentators use it?
It's far more likely in the Arab press to be paired with more sort of affirmative adjectives. So it tends more to have the resonance of Main Street would have in some American discourse. It might even have more of a sort of empowerment connotation to it, the power of the people, the will of the people, something like that. Though I would also argue that there's something a little bit problematic about referring to the entire public using that term, the street, because it tends to downplay the sort of rational reader of a newspaper sitting in his or her living room thinking about these issues dispassionately, and tends to privilege protesters who might be demonstrating in the street, which is just one aspect of public opinion.
So what's the provenance of the term? Did it begin in the Arabic press or did it begin in the Western press?
It's a little murky. I mean, we can trace it back to about the 1950s in both English and Arabic. At least the phrase the street was there in Arabic. It seems earlier than the phrase the Arab street was there in English. So it might be that people studying the Arab world, scholars and journalists, saw that this word, the street, was being used in the Arab world to refer to the public. And so they took it up, translated it, attached Arab to it, and started to use it. More recently, maybe in the past decade or so, in Arabic, they've started talking about the Arab street, and they've actually, interestingly, have started talking about the American street, the British street, the Israeli street. You see it applied to almost every part of the world that the Arab press covers, which already shows that the connotation is likely not to be as negative.
On our show, when we speak of Arab public opinion, we tend to say the Arab street, probably for the reason I cited, but, you know, maybe not. In any event, would you think we should shy away from it just because it can be stigmatizing in some way?
I would say either start applying it very widely to other publics in other parts of the world or treat it with a little bit of caution. I mean, it seems to cast the Arab public in a bit of a sui generis light and to set it apart from publics in other parts of the world.
All right. Point taken. We are chastened.
I'm not the Lang police or anything, but, you know, I think...
Oh, aren't you? Now, isn't this a little speech codifying that we're engaging in here?
I wouldn't want to outlaw any phrase. I just would want to heighten your listeners' sensitivity and maybe get them to question exactly what it connotes for them.
Mohammed, thank you so much.
Sure, my pleasure.
Mohammed Ali Khalidi is a professor at York University in Toronto. Egypt's uprising has put the country in an unusual place on the front page of U.S. newspapers. So the past 2 weeks have seen American journalists rushing to find themselves resident Egypt experts. Not always a pretty sight. On the cable news channels in particular, guest pundits of questionable credentials and less than sterling bona fides fielded questions that didn't do much to clarify for the viewers what was going on in Cairo. Lawrence Pintack is dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State University and author of The New Arab Journalist, Mission and Identity in a Time of Turmoil. He's been watching the dumb expert parade on U.S. news and mostly slapping his forehead. Lawrence, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you. I'm just kind of pressing that wound on my forehead.
Okay, so first thing I want to do here is establish your bona fides. You have spent a good part of your career in the Middle East, especially in Cairo. Just give me the brief resume.
Sure. I went to the Middle East first in 1980 as CBS Middle East correspondent. And most recently, before this gig, I ran the only graduate journalism program in the Arab world.
So that's you. And before we get to the specific examples of bad coverage, in the general narrative, what misperceptions are being foisted upon us about this story?
The Muslim bogeyman. This whole idea that Egypt is a potential Iran, that the Muslim Brotherhood's going to come to the fore, and Islamist extremism is going to sweep across the region. They are an opposition force in Egypt, no doubt. They do not represent the majority of Egyptians, and they are not a radical force. They are a relatively moderate conservative political force. Subtleties are very difficult to convey in a 15-20-second soundbite. We love oversimplification in the American media, and I say that as a former CBS correspondent.
That said, comes January 25th, the day of rage, and the cable news doesn't have a lot of time for nuance gathering. They've got to get some talking heads. How have they done?
Not very well. In their defense, the first couple of days, it was hard to get anybody in Egypt where, you know, the majority of experts were. The problem was that basically people who knew nothing about the topic were analyzing it to each other, pulling ideas out of thin air.
Got an example for me?
One quick example. I did a CNN segment a few days ago, and it was me. It was somebody who does a digital website, knows something about digital media, but nothing about the Middle East, and a comedian. And that, to me, just kind of summed up the whole thing.
Was it an Egyptian comedian?
No. Pete Dominic.
Okay. Let's hear what that sounded like.
Pete, let me ask you this. Could this uprising have happened before the internet?
Absolutely, Drew Griffin. I actually think Facebook and Twitter have really been integral in these revolutions, not only in Egypt, but I shouldn't call them revolutions.
Do you know how you got yourself in a situation where you're playing Frick to Pete Dominic's Frack?
I got a call from a booker at CNN and said, we have this thing they call the stream team. We want to do it on social media and the Egyptian revolution. Made sense to me at the time.
I'm going to play another piece of tape as evidence of what happens when bookers get desperate. This is from MSNBC, Lawrence O'Donnell's show, where to discuss the subject of the turmoil in Egypt, they found
Cleo Brock Abraham, who taught at an American school in Cairo for a year. Cleo, you taught fifth graders in Egypt. What kind of access do they have to Facebook?
They're all on Facebook.
Addicted to Facebook?
I would definitely say addicted to Facebook.
The other piece of this is that she's teaching at an American school in Egypt. We're not talking about fifth graders of the Egyptian masses. We're talking about either American kids or the Egyptian elite.
Okay, so it's easy to scoff and be jocular. That said, the stakes are extraordinarily high here. The future of a large, important country hangs in the balance. Is there any harm, actual harm, being perpetrated by cable news's casual approach to getting it right?
Absolutely. If American public opinion drives policy at a certain level, and if Americans in general comes away with the idea that actions by the Obama administration are setting up another Islamist dictatorship, that is going to make it that much harder for the U.S. to put an intelligent policy in place. The fact that Anderson Cooper got punched the other day, which was the news on CNN, is not the news. The fact that thousands of people have been injured over the last couple of weeks and quite a few dead, that is important news.
Thank you, Lawrence.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Pintack is the author of The New Arab Journalist, Mission and Identity in a Time of Turmoil.
Saad Eddin Ibrahim, former head of the Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies in Cairo, is currently a distinguished visiting professor at Drew University in New Jersey. A mild-mannered educator, human rights advocate, and hero to the world's press, he was threatened often by Islamic extremists and jailed by the Mubarak regime. Here he is speaking this week on Australian television.
And telling the truth is a very hard role to perform in authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regimes. But I'm proud that I did. I paid dearly for it. But now I feel vindicated.
Deborah Amos, a Middle East reporter for NPR, recalled how he challenged militant Islam in the 80s and 90s, its most violent period in Egypt.
There was a politician who was assassinated. Egypt's Nobel Prize-winning writer had his neck slashed because the Islamicists said that his book was anti-Islam. So it was a dangerous time to go on the record and say anything about these groups. And Saadeddine Ibrahim never shirked. He would always talk on the record about who they were and what they were doing.
Back in 2002, longtime Middle East reporter Rick Davis offered this portrait of Saadeddine Ibrahim.
You don't need a reporter to tell you that in this world, people mean and splendid exist alike. But in many parts of the world, among those with power, the mean do seem to outnumber the splendid. In over 20 years working in the Middle East, I often felt a bit like Diogenes, who with his lamp searched for an honest man. This is a tribute to such a man. He lives in Egypt. His name is Saadeddine Ibrahim.
If you believe in something, if you're a true believer, then you have to be prepared to take some risks. And I was prepared to take those risks. Still am.
Why in a country of over 70 million people is Saadeddine Ibrahim so rare? And why are his words so necessary to so many reporters? Susan Sachs of the New York Times has spoken with him often over the last 12 years on many issues.
Women's empowerment, clean elections, the role of religious minorities in Arab countries, and Islamic fundamentalism. These were all issues that he was interested in because he felt, I believe, that they would advance culture and society in Egypt. He is a patriot in the best sense of the word.
But not in the eyes of the Egyptian government. Late one night in June 2000, a dozen state security police stormed into his house. 40 to 50 more surrounded it. Across Cairo, 27 co-workers at his research center were arrested, lawyers, economists, social workers. One woman was jumped from behind, a bag thrown over her head. Soon they were on trial. Saadeddine Ibrahim, who had taught at major universities around the world, been a consultant to the United Nations, was now a 61-year-old man in a cage, a large steel cage in a Cairo courtroom.
For years, I thought the threat to my life would be from Islamic militants. Now, it is equally from my own government. But that is our fortune or misfortune in the third world, is that when you speak for freedom or for democracy, you are stepping on many toes.
A highly placed Western diplomat said Ibrahim's comments on state corruption and calls for democratic reform angered someone at the top, or near the top. The charges he faced included embezzling funds donated by the European Union, although the Union said no funds were embezzled. He was charged with tarnishing Egypt in the eyes of the world. And the government-controlled Egyptian news media joined the attack. Cartoons, editorials, fabricated stories. Among them, that millions of dollars in checks were found in his office safe. One paper published a photo it said was of his American-born wife, Barbara, getting a standing ovation at the Israeli embassy in Cairo. She wasn't even in the country that night. And a more frightening story, that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon personally tried to intercede in his case.
And that endangered my life in prison, because there are a lot of fanatics in prison. And my family screamed out, and yet there was no way of getting their voice or getting these editors-in-chief of the three daily newspapers to retract, even though they knew it was a big lie.
Saadeddine Ibrahim and his co-defendants were found guilty. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison. After 10 months, an appeals court nullified the verdict and ordered a new trial. It is happening now. Ibrahim is back in a courtroom cage. Many journalists who know him or of him are speaking out in his defense. A Wall Street Journal editorial questioned the inaction of the U.S. government. Ibrahim holds an American passport. He is a U.S. citizen. Robert Pollack wrote the journal editorial.
It's pretty obvious that the U.S. government has an obligation to stand up for its citizens being persecuted overseas. You know, whether that's a white native-born citizen or whether that's a a person of color is a naturalized citizen. He's precisely the kind of voice we ought to be encouraging in the Arab world.
But how much more can we expect of that voice? A series of small strokes during his first trial and imprisonment have slowed his walk, but his will is undiminished.
As you grow older, maybe you get wiser, but you also get more determined that there's very little time left for you to carry out your agenda. And the agenda is still very long in this region. Agenda for peace, for democracy, for development, for human rights. And as I look back on my life, despite the long years of activism.
He paused, his eyes teared. I have interviewed him at least a dozen times and never seen that before.
I feel there's very little that was accomplished of that agenda, and still more to accomplish.
This has clearly not been an exercise in unbiased journalism. It is a tribute to an honorable man. For On the Media, I'm Rick Davis.
Saad Eddine Ibrahim spent 3 years in prison. He was released in 2003.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, offering an event marketing service that provides registration tools to small businesses and nonprofits. ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Late last month, the Senate approved some reforms to make it less comfortable for a lone senator to place a secret hold on a piece of impending legislation. The practice enables one anonymous senator to keep a bill from reaching the floor for a vote. Recently, it was used at the very end of the last Congress to kill the popular bipartisan Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. That motivated us to launch our ongoing Blow the Whistle project to draw attention to the practice and identify the senator who killed the bill. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, along with Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley, led the effort to reform the secret hold. Wyden says that initially, the hold was rarely used. It was a courtesy extended to senators who needed more time to study a bill or return to the district before voting. But that day is long gone.
A courtesy morphed over the years into one of the most sweeping powers any legislator has anywhere. I mean, the ability to anonymously block a piece of legislation affecting millions of people or a nomination that can have the same effect is extraordinary, and to be able to do it without some sunlight, I just think, is completely unacceptable.
In 2007, there was something called the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act, which mandated that senators had to go on public record after 6 days of placing the secret hold. But then the senators got around that by something called tag teaming. How I understand that tag teaming works, you need two senators. The first senator anonymously places the hold on the legislation, releases it after 5 days before his or her name is entered into the record. Then the second senator places the secret hold and after 5 days also releases it. Then the first senator picks up the hold again, and the process repeats itself indefinitely.
You could conceivably, by handing the baton off every 5 days, have this go on pretty much forever. So Senator Grassley and Senator McCaskill and I believe now we plugged the holes. We were able to ensure in this new version that that notice requirement, where you have to give notice within 2 days, that it's triggered from the moment a senator has objected.
In other words, the senator who puts the hold on the bill has to reveal him or herself within 48 hours. And if he or she doesn't come forward, it gets attributed to the senator's party leader, right? Or whoever placed it on his behalf.
You have got it. There will be a public owner of every hold.
I don't think you've plugged the hole, Senator, because they can hide behind their party leader.
The combination of the shorter disclosure, requirement and consequences, where one senator is going to actually have to be a public owner, and we don't think that somebody is going to want to publicly take responsibility for a hold, is the big difference. The fact today is that nobody is responsible. A particular senator could say, I'm not objecting, I'm just objecting on behalf of someone else, and then you've got two senators who aren't accountable.
The Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act was held secretly just a few hours before the end of the 111th Congress. It effectively circumvented the six-day rule. It also would have circumvented the two-day rule.
If you get this down to 2 days, and there's going to be a public holder of all holds, you have brought some predictability and some certainty into a process that has had none. In fact, I can tell you this has already dominated discussions in both the Democratic caucus and the Republican conference, with senators wondering about how they're going to deal with something that for the first time has dramatic change in terms of their lives. I can tell you that if the United States Senate ever released its archives of all the secret holds that were placed over the last decades, you would have to have biographies rewritten with respect to exactly what the consequences were of those secret holds.
The pressure that is placed on a senator who would put a secret hold on impending legislation now is essentially fear of embarrassment or exposure. If they didn't have any shame, they could go ahead and continue to exercise this extraordinary power that allows them to hide from their constituents.
What I can tell you is last year, when it finally came to light that a United States senator had 70 holds on bills and nominations and sunlight was brought to it, the senator essentially lifted their hold immediately. So that would be one concrete case of how sunlight makes a difference.
But it's really, really hard to unearth the names of people who have placed the secret holds. We've been trying for weeks to get to the bottom of who placed the hold on the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act.
There is no question about it being a huge challenge, and that's why starting 17 years ago when I was trying to pass a public interest, measure that low-income advocates from all over the country wanted to expand care for community health centers. I vowed, since that bill was held up by a secret hold, that I was going to get it changed. I believe this is going to produce very substantial changes that will make government more open and more accountable. And I can tell you, if this wasn't so consequential, you wouldn't have had the Friends of Secrecy in the United States Senate fight it for so long, so hard.
So one last question. Who placed the hold on the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act?
I still am not clear on who placed the hold on the Whistleblower Protection Act, but I can tell you in the last days of the last session of Congress, two bills that I think were very important, the Whistleblower Protection Act and Senator Cornyn and I had a very important bill to fight sex trafficking, was also tanked this way, and that's why I've worked so hard to change the process.
Ron Wyden, thank you very much.
Thanks for your interest.
Ron Wyden is the senior senator from Oregon. While the secret hold was reformed last week, it was too late to save the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, and it was also too late for whistleblower Franz Geil. After retiring from the Marines in 2002, Geil immediately went back into civil service working at the Pentagon. In 2006, he landed in Iraq as a science advisor to Marine Lieutenant General Richard Zillmer. There, Geil kept hearing the same complaint from Marine commanders on the ground. Soldiers were desperately in need of new and better equipment. In particular, they needed transport vehicles that were less vulnerable to improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. What they needed were MRAPs, mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles. And in fact, Guile learned that a commander had already submitted an urgent request to Washington for MRAPs as far back as 2005, and the request had been ignored for 18 months. When Guile returned to the U.S. in 2007, he spoke out about how equipment shortages plagued the Marines, how they were still dying in Humvees 2 years after that commander's call for better armored vehicles. His campaign drew a lot of attention from Congress, from reporters, and, unfortunately, from his employers. Franz, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brooke.
So in 2006, when you were deployed as science advisor to Lieutenant General Richard Zillmer, what was the situation with regard to the MRAPs?
Well, the MRAPs hadn't been fielded en masse at that point, and that was a tragedy because the Marines and soldiers in Alambar province still needed to depend on armored Humvees for transportation. And the armored Humvees were being routinely destroyed by the ever more sophisticated IEDs. The same sorts of attacks wouldn't have damaged or destroyed MRAPs to the same extent, and there would have been many more survivors and far fewer maimings.
So briefly describe what steps you took to step up the delivery of MRAPs.
When I came back to the United States and to the Pentagon, I went ahead and tried to bring up the issue that the urgent need in 2005 had been buried in the bureaucracy and that that had cost lives.
So was the situation remedied by the time you came back and you were drawing attention to a past mistake, or was the problem still ongoing?
It wasn't just the MRAP. There were many, many other capabilities and devices that have been requested that have been slowed down or stopped altogether. So the MRAP was just sort of the poster child for these things. The procurement of MRAPs had certainly been set in motion. As soon as I made my disclosures and eventually to the media and to Congress, after contacting or being contacted by then-Senator Biden's office, I did talk to Tom Vandenbroek of USA Today, and this was in early 2007. And that led to a pretty significant article that was, as I understand today, ultimately read by the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Gates. It was the first time that it was brought to his attention that there was really a problem, and it led to the MRAP becoming a priority program within the Pentagon for procurement.
Why do you think the procurement officers that you ran up against were resistant to the MRAP?
The fact is the MRAP was something that had no advocates in the procurement bureaucracy. It was an unanticipated request from the forces in Alambar province, and it was very expensive. It did not fit into the programs that Quantico, Marine Corps Combat Development Command officials, had envisioned.
So they would have had to have carved out some money from some other program in order to supply MRAPs.
Exactly. Fortunately, all the services have an urgent process for when the commander in the field determines that something is immediately needed that accelerates the procurement of those specific capabilities or devices. And independent of whether money has been programmed for that over the long term, it needs to be paid for now.
But the original request for MRAPs was buried for 18 months.
There was probably $1.5 billion request. That was a huge chunk of money. It would have come from programs that were already solid and healthy and moving along and had plenty of advocates. There was a strong institutional incentive not to reprogram, and that's the case with all bureaucracies. That's often in conflict with the immediate needs of the guys on the ground.
When your attempts to point out these issues failed internally, you went outside the chain of command, you went to the press. This was very effective in drawing attention to the issue, but it also had the effect of escalating action against you in the Pentagon.
Well, you know, bro, I mean, I'm a Marine, and, you know, I'm a part of the Marine family. I love the Marine Corps. It's been my whole life. The last thing I ever wanted to do was go completely outside the chain of command. I feel like a narc, like a traitor, leaving the family to report something very embarrassing. Well, when I did try to work within the system when I got back, I had a presentation set to go to the Office of the Secretary of Defense with these issues, not just MRAP, but many others, comparing the delays in fielding to the cost on the ground. As soon as my supervisor saw the actual words and examples I was using, I was prohibited from presenting as I was invited to do in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And so I had a decision to make. I can either continue to work inside the system, which was hopeless, obviously, or I can get this problem fixed.
Could you sort of summarize briefly some of the reprisal actions they took?
Okay, initially I got an official reprimand signed by my supervisors. Then I got a formal reprimand, which is a much more serious piece of paper that actually stays in your record. Then I got a proposal by my supervisor to suspend me without pay for a couple weeks. Well, that was reversed by the Office of Special Counsel, and they were very helpful, and Government Accountability Project has helped me out. Well, the next things that came up, rock-bottom appraisals. Then in 2009, I want to say, a performance improvement program, which is usually the last step before an employee is fired in the government. Finally, a proposal, a formal proposal, to demote me and rewrite my job description entirely to eliminate my troublesome science and technology advisory functions. They figure they demote me and they take away that particular responsibility, and that would motivate me to stop or leave the civil service altogether. Finally, relatively recently, there were Naval Criminal Investigative Service investigations. They investigated me three times. One of those investigations has now led to my current circumstance, in which I have now been stripped of all my security clearances, and I have been placed on administrative leave, and I have been banned from the Pentagon. Before that, I had a really good career. I mean, I was well-liked before that, and it certainly began to be a problem when I got back.
Now, if the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act had passed, you would have been able to challenge these investigations directly, right?
Yes. I would have had a right to fight the retaliatory investigation, the NCIS investigation, most importantly, the one that is connected to the reason I've been placed on administrative leave and stripped of clearances. I could have done it at the time it was initiated.
Also, if the act had passed, your suspension would have triggered your right to a jury trial and the chance to challenge the suspension of your security clearances.
Well, the most important thing on the jury trial is, yes, I would have been able to challenge immediately the proposal to indefinitely suspend me without pay. To date, most people in my position, the only protection they've had, and it happened with me too, is that some reporter who was concerned about this basically did the challenging, and in this case it was Jeff Smith from the Washington Post. He called the Marine Corps and asked them about this in preparation for writing an article, and within hours, the Marine Corps rescinded the action of proposing to suspend me indefinitely without pay. But that's not a legal protection. That's nothing that can be guaranteed that will happen again for every whistleblower. And a right to a jury trial would allow a jury of peers, not necessarily tied to the interests of the Pentagon or the Marine Corps, to take a look at the thing objectively.
Knowing what you know now, would you have done anything differently?
No, I really did try to stay within the process with the permission of my supervisors, which I initially had. But it became so clear that possible negligence by officials, either knowing or unknowingly, allowed delays to take place that had measurable cost and tragic casualties on the ground. That couldn't leave the Marine Corps, and we weren't even willing to discuss it with the Department of Defense. And when that avenue was shut permanently, that's when I went to the press and, most importantly, to Congress.
So what's the next step?
Well, in my case, I don't know. I think the Department of the Navy right now is looking at whether I deserve to hold security clearance based on what the Marine Corps is alleging against me. I'm a defective human being like anybody else. Anyone could have done things perfectly or better, but I was doing what I thought was the right and necessary thing at the time, and I'm glad that it had some positive impact, and I'd like to be vindicated at some level. And at the same time, be gainfully employed. Right now, I don't really feel that I'm gainfully employed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Franz Geil enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1974 and retired as a major in 2002 and is currently a civil servant on administrative leave from the Pentagon. Through the
efforts of our Blow the Whistle project, you, our listeners, have confirmed with the offices of 66 senators that they are not responsible for placing the anonymous hold that killed the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. But we are still searching for the one who did. Go to wnyc.org/blowthewhistle and find the senators that have not yet given us confirmation. Call their offices. Send us an email at blowthewhistle@wnyc.org with their response. And please be sure to get the name of the person you talked to. Happy hunting.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman, with help from Andrew Carson and Carlin Gallietti, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Kat Tier Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.